case number 11-1280 et al. KLB Industries, Inc., doing business as National Extrusion and Manufacturing Company, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Hastings for petitioner, Mr. Seed for respondent, Mr. Cuppas for intervener.
Mr. Hastings, good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Gary Hastings. I represent KLB. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if okay. Your Honors, the reason that the information requested at issue in this case is irrelevant is based on the board's Nielsen holding and this court's subsequent enforcement of Nielsen in Conagra. I'd like to read the two key sentences from Nielsen that we think make us win. This is a quote directly from Nielsen. It's in page 20 of our opening brief as well. The board said, "We therefore conclude that an employer's obligation under Truitt to provide a union with information by which it may fulfill its representative function in bargaining does not extend to information concerning the employer's projection of its future ability to compete. We consider that obligation to arise only when the employer has signified that it is at present unable to pay proposed wages and benefits." That is straight out of Nielsen. This court held the board to Nielsen in its Conagra decision.
Okay, but we've gone beyond that because I think the law now is that even if you're not in an inability to pay case, but in a competitive disadvantage case, if you make substantiatable claims, the union is allowed to check those claims. And isn't that really what we're arguing about here is the specificity of the claims you made and their ability to be substantiated.
I mean, I agree, Your Honor, that if you make a sufficiently specific claim, then you can be forced to substantiate that. But all KLB did in this case is make generalized competitiveness claims. It didn't say anything specific. To confirm that, look at the union's information request, which specifically just said, we need to this information because of competitiveness. Just competitiveness. That's all the board said. And that's where the Nielsen two sentences that I read for you, I think, is still controlling. Now, what the board did say to try to get away from Nielsen is they tried to draw a line between the type of information at issue. The board concedes that we didn't plead poverty, and they concede that our books, I'm just using that as a shorthand, are irrelevant in this case because we didn't plead poverty. But they're saying that things like our marketing plans and the prices we charge are relevant. So why do we think that distinction is wrong? First of all, we think it's unfaithful to the Nielsen part that I read for you. We think it's unfaithful to post-Nielsen precedent as well.
But Nielsen simply says that a competitiveness claim does not require the employer to open up his books. That's what Nielsen says. And that's what Conagra says after that. That's what those cases say. As you just acknowledged in your answer to Judge Henderson, a competitiveness claim could, under the board's precedent, allow the university to ask for specific information responsive to the claim. So, as Judge Henderson said, that's the question here. The question in this case is whether or not unless your position is that a general competitiveness claim never entitles a union to ask for information. Is that your position?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think a generalized competitiveness claim need not be verified under Nielsen and subsequent post-Nielsen authority.
So is the board's decision in Caldwell is wrong?
I'm sorry?
The board's Caldwell decision is wrong?
No, I actually agree with the Caldwell decision. In Caldwell, the claims were very specific. Here's what the employer said at the table in Caldwell. They said that the cost of doing business at the union's facility was higher than at two other specifically named plants.
And here, one of the arguments, you said the company here said here that it's facing serious competition from Asia. So is the union not entitled to ask for information to test that?
The saying that it's the competition is from Asia is still at a high level of generality.
Well,
and look at the union's information request. It didn't ask us about Asia. It asked us about our prices, our marketing plans, customers. It didn't ask us about what's going on in Asia. So the union's request wasn't tailored to that. If that was a specific claim, the information wasn't tailored to it. What else did the employer in Caldwell say, though? It said that the pay was lower at these other specifically identified plants for the same work. It said that the material costs were higher at the union's plant than at these two other specifically identified plants. It said in Caldwell that it lost business to specific companies with a specific pricing examples. KLB didn't say anything like that. KLB just said that it wanted to be more competitive. That's a generalized claim.
What about its claim about decreased productivity?
Again, assuming that a decreased productivity claim was subject to verification,
why,
union's information request.
But why wasn't it?
Well, again, it's a very generalized claim, but look at the union's information request,
Where
Your
does
Honor.
This standard come from about it being too generalized? Where do you get that?
Nielsen sets forth...
I thought the rule was that the union is entitled to sufficient information to test the employer's justification. What it can't do, it's got to be a targeted request, though. So isn't that the only question we ask?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because we think a generalized competitiveness claim is not subject to verification.
And what supports that?
Look at, like, the board's North Star decision, which we've cited to you. The information at issue there involved a list of competitors, forecasts, operating results, and costs. That would have borne on competitiveness. This court's own Conagra case involved sales to competitors was information that was at issue in that case.
Does it make a difference that the employer was asking for such a dramatic reduction?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in Nielsen and the other cases, they all involve concessionary proposals. Nielsen was concessionary, Conagra was concessionary, all of these are concessionary cases. Look at the Second Circuit's Stroman case. The information that was at issue in that case, names of competitors, production and management reports, customer and sales accounts, supplier invoices. These are all things that would go to your general competitiveness, and they didn't have to give them.
Let me ask you this. I thought your argument, and it's one that, I think is very strong, is that the specificity that occurred in this case occurred at the hearing. It did not occur in the negotiation stage. It did to the extent of the increased production cost and decreased production, but the information sought by the union was not directed at those claims. Those are what are could be called substantiatable claims. Their request for information didn't go to those. And I want you to look at the board order on DA 424. And in particular, on the right-hand column, do you have it?
Absolutely. I'm there. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to ask the same question to the board, and they're in a better position to answer since these are their words. But the board says the respondent did not invoke competitive pressure loosely as an abstract proposition or as an ever-present factor. And it was seeking substantial wage cuts, and it centered entirely on a present and pressing lack of competitiveness in specific markets. Okay, its representations encompass not only the source of competitive difficulties, rising production costs. Now, that was from my review of the record, mentioned during negotiations. But the day-to-day impact of those constraints on the company's business, including its difficulty in retaining customers and in paying employees in line with previous contracts. I can't find anything in the record, even at the hearing stage, but even if it were at the hearing stage, it'd be too late, where there's any evidence that this was disclosed or used by the employer during the negotiation period. Then you go to the dissent, and the dissent says on page 427, left-hand column, bottom of the left-hand column. For that matter, there is no record evidence that the respondents' negotiators, and that's the emphasis, ever claimed an inability to compete, or that it had said that it had lost or was losing customers, that competitors were undercutting its prices, and it took forever to find that that came from the hearing. That is, that these Asian companies, one of them was ready to undercut prices. That was never mentioned at the negotiating. And that it had to outsource bargaining unit work in order to meet competition. So I thought you were arguing that, I mean, I think it's clear that we're at the point where if the employer makes substantiatable claims, even in a competitive disadvantage case, if you go more specific than we're at a competitive disadvantage, that's all we're going to tell you, and that, of course, encourages hard bargaining. And Posner says that's a test of strength, not a ULP. But that once the employer says something specific during negotiations, the union can test the sufficiency or the accuracy of that. And what here, that's why I went through that so painstakingly, because the way I saw this case was pretty much everything the board relies on as being substantiatable was produced at the hearing, not during negotiations.
I mean, I agree with that, Your Honor. One of the problems with the board's decision is, of course, they were relying on our trial presentation. But at trial, we were defending against an 8-3 allegation that said that our lockout, an issue of enormous significance to KLB, I mean, this is a company destroying unfair labor practice given the back pay at issue. They said that it was based on union animus. We needed to produce a legitimate business reason at trial to defend against that allegation. And so we produced information about lost customers and things like that at trial that we never mentioned in bargaining. And then the board tried to say, well, you said this at trial and now it's relevant, that shows it's relevant in bargaining, but it wasn't said at the table. And that, I think, is an error that really infected the board's analysis of the information request issue. Your Honor, the final thing I'd like to say on the information request is that the dividing line that the board tried to raise between the books, undisputedly irrelevant in our case, and everything else that could bear on competitiveness, when you look at that, set aside the case law, that dividing line is arbitrary and irrational because our books bear on our competitiveness. If an employer has huge profits, if it has a strong balance sheet, if it has lean management, it's in a better competitive position than an employer that lacks those characteristics. If we need to substantiate a competitive disadvantage claim, why don't we have to give them the books? We should have to, but the board admits that's irrelevant. That shows that the line they're arguing here is arbitrary and that we should win on that. But I'd like to move to the lockout, which, as you can imagine, is a really important issue for KLB. We should win the lockout even if we lose on the information request for a number of reasons. First of all, the board found that KLB bargained in good faith on all issues. In the KLB's lockout was in support of its final offer. Its final offer was made.
Is that? I don't think that's relevant. If the board's right that the company should have responded to the information request, doesn't make any difference that you were bargaining in good faith.
Well, I think it absolutely matters, Your Honor, that we're bargaining to get an agreement in overall in good faith, especially under the unique facts of this case. The final offer was made before the information request was even made. The union's best offer, the closest.
They continued to negotiate after that.
They did.
And many more offers were made. And they went all up and down, both sides.
But looking at the the bargaining pattern is as follows, though. The union's best offer, the closest it came to KLB before the lockout, was made on September 30, before the information request. The union regressed significantly away from KLB after September 30. And then by the time of the lockout, the union was still further away from KLB than it was on September 30. This shows that the bargaining was deadlocked over economics. And also, Your Honor, there was a complete absence of the evidence that the information request affected the bargaining. And that's what the board standard requires, that the information request has to materially affect bargaining. The union never told KLB, we can't understand your proposals. They never said, we need information in order to figure out what to do. KLB never pled poverty, so the union knew that KLB was just disagreeing with its proposals, that it, not that it couldn't afford it. The union never mentioned the information request before or after the lockout in the bargaining. They took two votes on KLB offers. They submitted it to the membership for ratification twice without any of the information and without coming back to KLB and saying, we need information, that's why we're rejecting your offer. They just said the wages were unacceptable. They didn't say we need more information.
Now, wait a minute. Did you just say that the union didn't say why it needed this information?
It never explained rejection of company proposals by saying we didn't have information.
Well, okay, all right. But you're, because their information request is prefaced with, during the course of these negotiations, the company has continually asserted that it must improve the competitive position of the Bellefontaine, Ohio facility. And then they asked for the information. So
I mean,
it's tied to the whole competitiveness thing. You're not.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I'm saying that they didn't say, I'm trying to explain why the information request didn't materially affect the bargaining. The union never invoked a lack of information as a reason for why it was confused or it couldn't make proposals or it couldn't assess proposals that KLB had made.
The ALJ found that this issue was central to the bargaining. I mean, he made that finding.
He found that the wage issue was
very
central.
Different, yeah, and that the information was critical to the wage question.
The information, though, Your Honor, doesn't have anything to do with wages.
Yeah, but you've got the union on October 21st saying, and again, the company has failed miserably to supply essential information regarding the company's proposals to wage reductions to the union, and before that, with respect to union, maintains it is entitled to all documents and information called for in our October 4th letter.
They said that, Your Honor, in response to the company's letter announcing a lockout, though. They didn't say that in connection with we can't. I mean, they had already rejected the company's timed offer on October 8 without any of the information. KLB had made its final offer on October 3, which the lockout was supporting, way before the information request, before the information request was even on the table.
Right.
So, again, to taint our lockout.
Well, let me just be clear what your concept is here. The employer comes in and says, we want to cut wages 20%. The union says that's unacceptable. The employer says, we need to do that to stay competitive. And it goes back and forth like that for a while. So finally, the employer says, here's our timed offer. You don't accept it. We've reached impasse. So then what? The employees are locked out. New employees are temporarily hired. The board's vision of collective bargaining, it seems to me, in interpreting the statute, is a little different. And isn't that the concept undergirding the board's rationale here?
Well, I mean, what the board has said in information request cases is the board has to prove that the failure to provide information materially affected the bargaining. In this case, there's no evidence.
I'm not going to get to that Peterbilt issue yet, but in other words, here, the parties have basically reached agreement on everything else, although I assume you're going to get to the health care point. But and so the ALJ and the board say this was the critical issue. The only explanation by the employer was competitiveness, and the union had requested some information. So why do we want to have this disruptive process when this is a core issue, the information is relevant, says the board, the employer ought to turn it over.
And you can engage in hard bargaining and say, we're not being competitive, here's our wage reductions, that's all we're going to do, and you face the very expensive, as you've already pointed out, lockout. I mean, that's the alternative, and that is an alternative.
Right, and we think that the Act absolutely authorizes that alternative. I mean, the Act is neutral on economic weapons, and you know the employer has a right to lock out in support of its good faith bargaining position. That's where I think the board's good faith finding.
Yeah, but
is
I thought
important.
You were making the argument that these that the information request was not material related to that to the bargaining, right?
I'm saying it's not materially. It did not materially affect the progress of negotiations in this case.
Here's what the ALJ said: absent the union's willingness to buy a pig in a poke, that information was critical to the bargaining and bargaining process.
But Your Honor,
and the board said company is not entitled to lock out employees for refusing to accept proposed wage benefits, wage cuts, while at the same time failing to fulfill its statutory duty to respond to requests for information relating to that proposal. So the board did say it was material, both the ALJ and the board.
But, Your Honor, the pig and the poke argument is wrong for at least two reasons. Uh-huh. First of all, the union was willing to pay more for that pig on September 30 before it even made the information request. And secondly, KLB never pled poverty. So the union knew all along that KLB could afford its proposals. The dispute, the deadlock, was caused by economics. It wasn't caused by information. The union always knew that KLB could afford the proposals.
You've got findings here that are to the contrary, right?
I don't see how there could be any supportable finding that that KLB, you know, that we never pled poverty, that's been found, and that the union knew that we could afford their proposals. And it's certainly correct that the information request was made after the union's September 30 offer and after our final offer. And in my recital of when the information request got invoked, it wasn't at the table. It was in response to the lockout letter.
So your argument is basically the board has to take an either-or position given these economic weapons, and it should sanction a system of these costly lockouts. And I'm just trying to understand your concept here. And unless the employer says, you know, we'll have to file for bankruptcy, unless you agree to this 20% reduction, there's no obligation to provide any information. I mean, the board's response is that maybe the union wouldn't have been as strong in its objection to your client's proposals had it realized what the basis of them, for them was.
But, Your Honor, there's no evidence to support that speculation that the union would have agreed to our proposals.
The board is looking at the process in a global sense. And as I understand it, your argument is that it shouldn't look at it in that way, that collective bargaining should not be this give and take between the party. It's one party comes in and says, we want this. The other party says, we disagree with that. Impasse, lockout, we're up here in the Court of Appeals.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the Act is agnostic towards the deployment of economic weapons. For example, if the union had struck
us. I'm saying the board has interpreted, Congress delegated to the board that authority, and it's taken a more global approach toward what are the interests underlying, well, the interest is stability in labor management relations, and this type of give and take exchange promotes that.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I agree if the information request had materially derailed the negotiations, then the lockout could be found illegal. For example, the case that the board cited, the Globe Furniture case. In that case,
is your take then that suppose the union had hypothetically asked for four documents and the employer gives three to the union, then the burden would be on the union to show that it was the fourth document that was critical?
It would be on the union to show that the failure to adequately respond to the information request materially affected the negotiations. And again, the example is the Globe case, where the employer withheld cost information that prevented the union from costing proposals and was complained about constantly throughout the bargaining, and the union said that we rejected your final offer because we don't understand it.
So let me understand here, do you see the board's Your objection to the ALJ's decision stated that the error was in that your client had no obligation to furnish customer quotes, outsourced work, past customers, prices, market studies, and or market plans. So that's
right.
Six things.
Right.
Do you see that as the same as opening your books?
I think it's debatable. I mean, all the information.
No, that's my point is the board is taking not this either-or position in these various issues. It's trying to come up with some. You don't have to open your books and have the union audit your records.
Well, and that's the line, I think, Your Honor, which we would say is arbitrary, because there's no material distinction between our books with respect to our competitive position and this information, prices, our customers, quotes and stuff like that. I mean, why shouldn't we have to open our books if we have to tell them what our prices are? I mean, I think that is an arbitrary line.
I'd say maybe you don't want to go that extreme. It's either or, where the board has offered you a middle ground.
Well, I mean, the middle ground, I mean, that's pretty sensitive information, Your Honor, to be giving to a union in the middle of contract negotiations.
The regulations provide for all kinds of protections.
But it also, though, it leads to unproductive discussion at the table when you know that we can afford your proposals, which is this case. Why would we need to debate with the union about whether our prices could be raised or we could, you know, get more customers or things like that? That has nothing to do with terms and conditions of employment.
No, but it's directly related to the company's claim about competitiveness.
But the books would be related to competitiveness too, Your Honor.
I don't think you win your case by saying that. I think your best argument is that this isn't related to the request, not that the board could have required you to produce more.
I'd be happy to adopt that argument,
yeah,
too, Your Honor.
Right.
I'm sorry, I've gone so far over. I hope the court has indulged me greatly.
All right, we'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Side for the Labor Board. Company counsel in its argument this morning, as it did in its briefs, does appear to recognize that the board can properly require an employer to substantiate a competitiveness claim. The board reasonably found that the facts here were akin to many other cases where it has required an employer to support such a claim, and the policy is also entirely consistent with the principles laid down long ago by the Supreme Court in the Truer Manufacturing case. The board found that in this particular case, the employer had made some claims that were both present and pressing regarding its lack of competitiveness.
And when did it make those claims?
It made those claims, Your Honor, at the hearing, and they were further confirmed it made the claims during the bargaining, and they were further supported by evidence that came out at the hearing.
When and where did they make them during the negotiations?
Sure. There was testimony from the union witness that the negotiations, quote-unquote, centered on competitiveness, and that was specifically credited testimony at pages 451 and 452, and the testimony itself is at page 76 of the appendix.
Okay, that's not substantiatable, that claim, just that we're at a competitive disadvantage. The cases are clear on that. You've got to have something that's substantiatable. Go ahead.
Right. It's centered, and then very specifically, that there was increased competition from Asian companies, and then
that
very specifically.
That was at the hearing.
That was at the hearing, correct. That was at the hearing. That was the company witness at pages 164
right.
and 160.
During the negotiations.
And 167, correct, and also that production was down. That was made during the hearing. And it was also reasonable for the board's finding in context that at the hearing, at pages 104 and 105 of the appendix, it was actually in the opening statement, the company stated that going into the negotiations, it was facing business conditions that it had not faced before, and that it wanted to send a specific message to the union that these negotiations were going to be different. So for the board to make a finding and an inference that the union understood that these negotiations, this wasn't just some general competitiveness claim, but these were dealing with some very specific and very real issues that the company was facing, that was a very reasonable conclusion for the board to draw.
Do you agree with the petitioner that if it's just a general competitiveness claim, there can be no appropriate information request?
Your Honor, the board does evaluate cases on a case-by-case basis, and in
right.
general, where there have been competitiveness claims, there usually are claims, as there are here, that there's some comparison or recognition, whether it be another plant or some type of other employer or company that it's facing issues with.
But would you agree with the company that if the employer just says we're at a competitive disadvantage and nothing more?
Your Honor, in that situation, obviously the whole fundamental aspect of bargaining is that you do want an exchange of ideas and information between the parties. And so if all an employer did was simply set forth a very dramatic wage decrease, or propose it, refuse to say anything about what the basis is, where it's coming from, that would certainly open up an employer to potentially a bad faith bargaining or surface bargaining charge if that's all that it did.
Well, how about your language out of Bartlett Tree Expert, where the board said the basis for the request, that the information contained in the contracts is necessary to make a reasonable wage proposal is nothing more than another way of saying that it is needed to bargain intelligently, and this general claim is simply insufficient to establish relevance. As for the general counsel's contention that the contracts must be provided because the respondent made an issue of them, we think the general counsel has misapprehended the significance of the references to the contracts by the bargaining representatives. In other words, as Judge Posner said in that graphic communications, there's a difference between a test of strength, hard bargaining, and an unfair labor practice. And I mean, both sides assume a risk, and the employer in this case assumed the risk of the expense of the lockout. And of course, that was a risk to the worker.
Well, Your Honor, obviously the employees are the ones that are being, but they are being asked to buy a pig in a poke, because the employer in this case has made some very specific representations. The company has refused to.
Yeah, but wait. I thought you had conceded in response to Judge Henderson's question that the specificity didn't come until the hearing, and that up until that point, it was a general competitiveness claim. Is that accurate?
No, Your Honor.
No.
What the board had found, and very specifically credited testimony from the union negotiator, right, was that the negotiations had centered on competitiveness.
Okay.
And within that, there had also been very specifically testimony about production costs and other things going on. But the company witness actually very specifically testified at pages 164 and 167 that within the competitiveness claim that there was a decrease in production and that there was issues that the company was facing from.
And was his testimony that those were raised by the company during the negotiations?
During the negotiations, that is.
During the negotiations.
During the negotiations. And for the union.
Where is it in the record? It would have helped if this transcript were not so truncated that sentences aren't even complete. But the only thing I could find was that on cross-examination of the union negotiator, Conrad Young, he was asked, with respect to explaining why the company wanted concessions, isn't it true that Mr. Hastings said more than just they needed to be competitive? Answer, I don't recollect anything other than competition without other companies, without them naming the companies, and it all centered around competitiveness. And then the question is, did Mr. Wakefield tell you that the company's production cost was decreasing? I think he means increasing, isn't that true? And he says competitive, yes, competitiveness. And did he also tell you the productivity of the employees was decreasing? I don't recall that. I mean, I didn't see anything in the record that even the union admitted was said during negotiation.
Your Honor, at page 167 of the record, and this is a question that's being asked of the company negotiator, did KLB say anything to the union regarding why it wanted to achieve cost savings in this collective bargaining agreement in 2007? Answer, we indicated to them that we wanted to stay competitive. We were competing with the Asian firms, that our cost per hour had risen and our production itself had dropped. So there were some very specific claims that were being raised.
And who was that?
That was a company negotiator testifying.
That was Hastings. Okay.
Correct.
But the information request didn't talk about who are your competitors. It didn't ask for information about who are your competitors in this market. Where is this competition coming from? It asked about, we're going to go see your former customers to see if they really left you, why they left you. We're going to go to the current ones to see if they're thinking of leaving you.
I understand the court's concern about the information request, and however, before this court, the only claim that the company had raised to the board was some confidentiality concerns.
Right.
It never raised any other. That is not before this court at all. It never raised any types.
What they did request didn't go to these Asian markets or the identity of competitors.
That's not it. The company had every right to go back to the union and suggest that maybe there might be other information that it could provide, and that's a give and take that can take place during bargaining. The company's position before, all the way throughout the negotiations and obviously throughout the hearing and now before this court, was simply that absent an inability to pay, it has no obligation to provide any substantiating claim. And I would point out, as the board did find, information about customers, information about bids that does go directly to competitiveness. It is information that the board has required in the past, such as in the A1 door case that's cited to, obviously, in the briefs and relied on by the board, in the DuPont case that goes back to 1985. It's information about production that is not something that's unique that's ever been asked of or that the board has required an employer to provide before.
Did you say the employer did give that?
In other cases involving and the employer had every ability to come back in this case during the negotiations and inform the union of any particular issues that it might have had with the information request. And outside of claiming confidentiality with a few issues that are not before this court, it simply did not do so. So for it to now claim at this late date that the information is not relevant because it should have been asked in a different way, that is simply not something that this court needs to be to address or be concerned with.
Well, they may be making an argument that is neither here nor there, but what about our case law, the board law about these substantiatable claims, that when you're not in an inability to pay case, the only requirement to give information is to test substantiatable claims. And the Asian market didn't come up until the hearing. I mean, I just can't find where the board ever during the negotiation said, look, we're losing to China. We lost this customer. Now, they did say that at the hearing, and it cost us millions, but I don't see where they said or that the union said that they said it during the negotiations.
Ronald, I see that my time is up.
Do you mind just read a sentence from the testimony which said that it did come up at the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the site for that?
I was at page 167 when it talked about you were competing with the Asian firms and that their and that their production had dropped. And again, I would refer
that their production
had dropped.
Right, but does he say that that was an issue during the bargaining?
I think so.
Yes, that was told to the union during the bargaining. That's correct.
Right.
And the
question is, did KLB say anything to the union regarding why it wanted to achieve cost savings in this collective bargaining agreement in 2007? Answer. We indicated to them that we, wanted to stay competitive and we were competing with the Asian firms, and also that our cost per hour, per production hour had risen, and our production itself had actually dropped a little. Now, they didn't ask about that. I mean, the union didn't ask for information about those two things. So even though they said that in the negotiations, the information request wasn't directed to them.
But, Your Honor, and again, I see that my time is up, but presume that I can answer the question. The information request dealing information about customers, dealing with information about marketing surveys, that is all relevant to competitiveness. And if the employer had an issue with the way that some of the information was being sought, it had every right to take issue during the bargaining with the union outside, again, of claiming confidentiality. It just steadfastly, repeatedly kept to the position that absent an inability to pay, it was not going to disclose any reason or any basis for why it needed such a substantial wage reduction or why it was seeking such a substantial wage reduction. And the request that the union made is actually on the right track. And the whole underpinnings of the act. If the employer had in any way, shape, or form, and maybe it didn't have to be in exactly the way that the union had asked, but indicated that it had just lost a customer, indicated a major customer, indicated that it was losing some bids, indicated that this was the reason for why, particularly in that first year, there was a need for such a substantial wage reduction, that would give the information that the union could at least make an informed choice, not buy a pig in the poke, and go back to principles that underlie the act going back decades.
Just one more question. Did I understand you to say earlier, again, in response to Judge Henderson's question, that this issue is not properly before us?
The issue as far as whether some of the particular information that's being requested
is not.
With the understanding or assuming that the board's order gets enforced, that the claim of competitiveness here did require the employer to provide information, then the specificity of the information requested here, that in and of itself is not before any challenge.
Is that because before the board, the employer only argued that they had no obligation to provide any information?
Outside of raising some issues regarding that some of this claim was confidential or some of the information was confidential, that claim has been weighed before this court. And then, again, it has drawn a very sharp line that outside of an inability to pay, there's simply no requirement to provide this information.
Judge Arter. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Cooper.
Good morning. May it please the court. The company began its presentation at the hearing with these statements about negotiation. And I'm quoting, KLB wanted to send a message to the union that these negotiations were different.
What page is that?
That's on page A105 of the appendix, page 893 to 94 of the transcript. It went on to say KLB faced in 2007 negotiations with business conditions it had not faced in previous years. KLB had suffered a customer setback. The union got that message with the 20% wage reduction proposal, and it responded with questions that turned out to be highly pertinent. The union asked about customers, it asked about lost customers, it asked about prices, it asked about marketing plans. The company responded by flatly saying that's all irrelevant, and what's more, it's all governed by confidentiality agreements we have with our clients. The company then went on to prove that its response to the union was false, because at the hearing it introduced Exhibit 13, which is a detailed list of sales figures from its top 20 named clients for the last 3 years, showing year-to-year sales, client-to-client sales. And in its brief to this court, it accurately characterizes that as going to establish a legitimate rationale for seeking cost savings. If you look at the document, it is indeed highly pertinent to the claim that they were facing immediate pressures in the marketplace, because what it shows is that from 2005 to 2006, company sales increased by 44%. In 2007, they suffered a slight reduction that is accounted for by losing one client, but an overall increase from 2005. So the general competitive position of the company, as demonstrated by that document, was quite strong. Now, it may indeed have faced an emergency that would justify its immediate demand because it lost a big client. But if the union had seen those figures, it could have either understood the company's need and responded to it as it said it would, or it could have tried to refute it.
Is it your position that the substantiatable claim could not have been substantiated, I guess?
No, it may have been. If they did lose a client from 2006 to 2007, as their witnesses say is the basis for their position. But part of disclosing the information is to allow the union to say, oh, yeah, we see you have a point. Let's talk about that. But the company denied the union the opportunity to see that they might have had a point. It also denied the union an opportunity to discuss whether they did have a point. But the one thing that's clear and indisputable is that the information in that document, which they had at the time, was germane to bargaining. The union was right that the bargaining was all about immediate pressures the company was feeling from having lost business. The company admits that. The union understood it. It was conveyed by the negotiating posture. The company came in and said, we need a 20% wage reduction right now, and it needs to be in the first year. When they moderated their position, they said, now we need an 8% wage reduction right now because we face an emergency due to pressures on us. These are people who made $30,000 a year, and they're coming in and demanding wages that would put them below the poverty level for families of four. The demand conveyed an emergency, and the demand was justified by pressures the company was feeling in the marketplace. And they had the information right there. Their witness said that they prepared it month to month. Their chief negotiator prepared this. They had that document, and they refused to give it to the union.
All right.
But I keep coming back to the law about the substantiatable claims. And is it your position that the company cannot stonewall, cannot play hardball?
They run a risk if they do. If the company comes in, they run a legal risk if they do. Well, if the company comes in, and the main dispute that the company was defending against was that its bargaining position was so unreasonable that it engaged in surface bargaining. And, a 20% wage reduction, if it had been totally unexplained, if the company had just come in and said, because we want to,
okay.
They would have run the risk that they would have...
found that did not engage in...
No, I know. That's right, because they offered some explanations. They offered some leeway. They said that they were facing pressures. If they had just stonewalled, they would have run a legal risk. They didn't just stonewall.
If they had stonewalled what?
If they had just stonewalled, if they had just come in and said, we want draconian wage reductions, we're not going to give you any indication why... Mm-hmm. That would have run legal risks, too. But my point
what,
is...
bad faith bargaining?
Pardon me?
Bad what?
Yes, bad faith bargaining. But my point is that they understood each other. That's why the testimony is so undetailed. I mean, the company's opening statement says what it was about. Everybody understood that with the demand, with the statements about immediate competitive pressure. It was very immediate, very specific.
So if they understood each other... then how did the union buy a pig in a poke?
No, what they understood each other was what they were talking about. The union understood correctly that the company was saying we face immediate pressures with our sales. They understood what they were saying. They didn't understand the details of what the company was talking about. So the union made information requests that would have disclosed eventually in a cumbersome way that information on Exhibit 13. But the company didn't, rather than say, well, we've got something we can give you, you don't need all that, here we'll show you our sales figures, something it was willing to put in a public transcript, was not at all confidential despite its claims, and it was highly relevant. It would have...
But it seems to me the board has said that, and the courts have said, that is up to the bargaining parties. We're looking at... graphic communication says that's a test of strength. I mean, if the company says, look, we're facing pressures, we've got, and I can't remember now whether they said we've lost one customer at the negotiating stage. I don't know if they said it at the hearing, I know. We've got competition from Asia. And the union said, well, we want to see the numbers. We want to see if we believe you. We want to go to the customers. We want to ask that customer you lost, whatever we want to ask him. And the company says, no, we've told you what we're going to tell you. Here's our proposal, and that's it. And it seems to me the cases say that the substantiatable claim is what, non-inability to pay case is what we're concentrating on.
Yes, I agree with you there that we're concentrating on a substantiatable claim, but the claim that the company conveyed at the negotiating table, and I don't think that there's any dispute about this, was that it faced a immediate and severe economic pressures that it needed relief under the contract in order to get out from under. And those were marketplace pressures. They were immediate and severe, and that is very specific. It was an emergency, they were claiming. In their testimony at the hearing, the union's request shows that the union correctly understood what they were saying, and the company confirmed it at the hearing. They said, yeah, that's what we meant them to understand. But 2007 was a special year.
But it wasn't an inability to pay.
No.
It wasn't an inability to pay.
No.
And the union heard this and what it asked for was not, well, let's look at, how much the competition has taken. Let's look at what you've lost from this customer. It was not directed to the substantiatable claim that the company was making, which was this pressing.
Actually, it was, with all respect, addressed to the lost customer, because one of the things they specifically asked about was to tell us which customers you've lost. And the union said, give us...
Didn't they also say, so we can go to
Yes, they said that, and I agree. I agree that that's a sort of implausible thing for a business person to want to do. So the correct response would have been, no, you don't need to bother our customers, because it so happens that we have a list right here that will show you customer by customer the year-to-year sales variations, so you don't need that. We could give you this list. But rather than do that,
Did you think the union, after having told them, so we can go to these people, just because the employer said, you don't need to, here's the information, that would have stopped the union?
It should have, and it would have been enough. If you look at that list, I would just urge the court to look at that exhibit, because it is very germane, very concrete information that goes directly to how immediate the company's needs were and what the nature of the need was.
I mean, it's not in the union's interest to aggravate the customers.
That's true. And if the company had responded by saying, no, we don't want you aggravating our customers, tell us what you want, or you've told us what you want, and we'll give you the information, the union would not be on very sound ground saying, oh, well, you know, we wanted to go, depending on circumstances, but, you know, given the information the company had here, I don't see that the union would have had to go running around asking that question. It could have gotten the information.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Mr. Hastings have any time? All right, why don't you take a minute?
I guess all I'll say really briefly is the customer issue that the union just discussed with you never came up in bargaining. Customers were never mentioned at the table. That list might have been producible had they said we've lost customers, but that never happened. To the extent there was any substantiatable claim made at the table, the union's information request was completely mismatched. There was nothing about Asia competition in there, and there was nothing about production costs in there. So it's a complete mismatch. That should be fatal to the information request theory. The only other thing I'd like to follow up with is Judge Rogers had suggested that I should talk about health care. There was more than a wage deadlock. There was a health insurance deadlock as well. As of the lockout, there was a dispute over coverages. The union wanted the same coverages, and the company's final offer had substantially similar coverages. And then the union regressed away from the union and went away from high the union regressed away from the company after the lockout and went back to the old insurance as opposed to the high deductible insurance. There's no issue on information with respect to health insurance in this case. None. So there would be an independent basis to uphold the lockout based on a deadlock over health insurance, even if there were a problem on wages.
I thought the board said, and the dissent agreed with this, that even if the lockout were lawful, the health insurance cancellation without notice and without an opportunity to bargain over it was a ULP.
Now, on that, the board missed it on two fronts. First of all, an employer doesn't have to subsidize, undercut its own economic weapon you're allowed to end health insurance after right. You do a lawful lockout. Right. And secondly, of course, the expired contract allowed us to end health insurance no later than the month after the month. The board turned that around into no earlier than the month after the month, and that was just wrong. Thank you. You guys were very patient with me. All right. Appreciate it.
This honorable court now adjourns tomorrow morning at 9:30.
You'll have to close this.